Today is April the 5th, 2017, and it is time for the Personal Computer Show. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. The program is on each Wednesday on PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. The radio program is streamed live on WBAI.org, and our website is PCRadioshow.org. And I'm Hank Key, and on a sad note, we'll start off the program by telling you that Bernie Appel passed away this Sunday, April the 2nd, at the age of 85. And for those who are old-timers, the name may sound familiar to you. Bernie Appel was the former chairman and president, and he was affectionately called Mr. Radio Shack. And in his 34 years working at Radio Shack, he started in 1966 when there were only three stores. Unfortunately, today they're up to seven stores, and they're on the downward slide. They're closing many of the stores. And for those, you may remember the TRS-80.
You know, the Trash 80. The
wait, let's not call it Trash 80. It was called TRS-80.
The Trash 80 was a couple of $1,000, and it was the first real desktop computer in the business for the people like you and me who weren't like Hank, who could build it from a paper bag full of parts. We were able to go into a store and in the neighborhood and buy a real computer and learn how to program. And we didn't have too many programs that we could run, but we could have a lot of fun with it.
Well, unfortunately, Radio Shack didn't move beyond the TRS-80, and the year after its, or actually 2 years after its introduction, IBM came in with their IBM PC, and that revolutionized the entire industry.
Well, what they did was, they instead of having the unique Trash 80, TRS 80 operating system, what IBM did is they went out to, I think the company was called Seattle Computing, and they bought their operating system and called it IBM DOS, I believe.
Yes, they called it DOS 1.0. And you know how big the program operating system was? 4K.
Well, that's more
reasonable.
Not
gigs, but 4K.
The first computer I actually owned was a K Pro 2, and it was running on CPM. And the CPM that it ran on took up, as I recall, 22K. It was a 24K machine, and it took up 22K. But you got more storage than you would ever need in your life because it had two floppy disk drives, and each one could hold 192K.
You know, I like the way you said that, Joe, because in the late 50s, I worked on the what was called the SAGE system. It was the air defense system, and we had a mass storage device that was 4K, and we really had to do a lot of tight programming, 4K only. We had to have all the wind speeds at different altitudes. You had to have the program in there. We squeezed everything we can out of it.
Well, you were working with bits, and I was working with bytes, byte
yes.
being 8 bits.
Yeah. Hey, Joe, you know, President Trump signed the repeal of the broadband policy. And for those who may not be aware...
Wait a minute. He did not sign a repeal of broadband policy.
Well, privacy policy, I said.
That's right.
Okay. And what happened was that in 2012, the past Congress had come up with a privacy act that affected only the ISPs, which is, in this case, the cable companies, the telephone companies, and so on. but they excluded the browser organizations. And Google then announced that they would effectively commence, and this was and March 1, this would go back to 2012, that the their privacy policy, which would enable them to gather and store search queries, history, and personal information from its users. And so to have a level playing field, you do one of two things, and I totally disagree with what was done. What you should do is you put the same kibosh on Google from making, you know, gathering all that personal data. But what the Congress did was they repealed it the way it affected the carriers. And I just feel that there should be privacy where there should be no metadata, no personal data gather. But I guess if people break the rules, there's not much we can do about it.
Well, this is not a politically oriented program, but I got to say this very political statement. When it comes to a choice between the citizens of this country and the big business of this country, the current operation in Washington is screw the citizens.
Well, now, there were actually two organizations that were excluded back in 2012. One was Microsoft, but Microsoft did a little differently. And most people don't realize that Microsoft, like Google, also gathers data. And with the operating system and their with their browser, IE, and then Edge now, they do gather data, but there is an option that you can opt out. And the default is, they don't tell you, but the default is you have to opt out if you don't want the data gathered. But in Google, there's no such thing. In Google, it's like, smile, you're on candid camera.
Well, there is a way to avoid the data from being captured, but it's a third party. And there's a whole bunch of people who...
Well, you don't mean third party. You mean there's an alternative method.
Yes, I should have said an alternative method. There's a whole bunch of people in the manufacturing of that type of software. And it's interesting. It's called VPN, Virtual Private Network. And as soon as Washington passed this ridiculous... They didn't pass a law. They canceled out the previous administration's law.
They repealed a law that was passed 4 or 5 years ago.
And as soon as they did that, the Google search for VPN went up 1,000%. VPN is about the only way you can protect yourself today, but it's not as simple as I'm saying. It's not just a matter, Hank, of putting on a VPN. You got to know what you're doing.
Well, you came up with three simple words. VPN, or virtual private network. Well, how does it function? What does it do?
It is actually, when you say virtual, you're immediately indicating it's not a physical thing. It sets up not an actual physical network, but a network in software that encrypts the data from the moment it goes into the network and right through to the endpoint.
Well, but it has to go through some carrier, right?
It does. It goes
through. Or does it have to?
But it goes through the ISP after, not before, but after it's encrypted. So they don't really know what the data is that you're using.
But in some organizations, they just go directly from point A to point B using their own community. You know, you could have a private communication use VPN, too. You don't have to have a public network, when I use the word public.
For individuals, the only way to get through the Internet and to get that kind of information is to go through an ISP.
For 90% of the people, you're saying. Okay, now, do you have to go through a browser?
You don't really, but in actuality you do. What I'm saying, you don't really. A person like you could figure out a hack around it. A person like me would have to use one of the various browsers that's compatible with the ISP that I chose.
Well, let me ask you. I know that it was announced, and I know a few people are using it. Maybe it'll start increasing, is Opera. And what made Opera so unusual was that you can turn on the VPN within the browser itself.
You can. Opera bought a very good VPN company. I think it was last year. It might have been the year before. And they integrated that software completely into the Opera browser. but not everybody uses the Opera browser, so Opera made the VPN available as a standalone product.
Well, let me ask you this, Joe.
Incidentally, I should add, it's a free standalone product.
Yes. Now, here's a question that some people have raised, and I've been doing a lot of reading on it. They say, well, one of the things is that if you the data, you're concerned about the data that the ISPs, I'll use the word ISP because although we use the term cable, broadband, but, you know, you have a
what does ISP stand for, Hank? Internet service provider.
Internet service provider, okay? But the thing is, it's not necessarily cable per se. It could be it could be laser. In other words, there are different ways of doing it. But they say that people can still get around it in the sense that they are still collecting the data where it's not necessarily the detail, but they at least they know where you're coming from. They know where the signal is emanating from, and that may be a piece of information that can, when you tie it in with other piece of information.
That's true if the ISP, if we're talking about the ISP, but if we're talking about, let's say if you're using the Opera browser, using the Opera VPN, they don't know where the data is coming from, and they don't know where it's going.
No, but let me put it this way. What prevents the VPN provider or the one or providing the product or the service from making that data available to and
well, the only data he can make available, he being she being the owner or operator, or let's take Opera in this case, the only data that Opera can make available is that data is going. That's it. Not how much, yes.
In other words, it's encrypted data.
It's encrypted. It's fully encrypted. I believe it's 256 and up. 256 AES.
Well, once you use the word encrypted, some of the people who may be listening to are saying, how hard is it to install? How hard is it to implement VPN under Opera? In fact, let's start off with, let's say, from scratch, where you say, okay, how do you get Opera to begin with? And is it something like the way you got Chrome?
Yes, it's exactly the way I got Chrome. I went, in my case, I have Android equipment. My tablet and my telephone are Android. And I went to the Play section, the Google Play, and I put in VPN, and I was given a number of choices, and I took the Opera choice. But if I had gone and put in browser and taken the Opera browser, I would have gotten the browser and the VPN both.
Now, I know that you use Opera before you implement VPN. Does it change the speed of operation where it slows it down, or it's you don't really notice a difference?
I don't know. I can't tell you that from a technical point of view, but from an operational point of view, I can't see a difference.
Well, I know that you've used you had used, i.e., you barely use Edge, but you have used Chrome extensively. Are functionally any great differences from at least your usage point of view?
No.
None at all?
None at all. If you're used to Opera, I'm sorry, if you're used to Chrome, some of your protocols are a little bit different. Some of the languages are a little bit different, but the concept of how you use it is exactly the same, and you'd learn the new technique very quickly.
Okay, the reason why I ask you that is because I've used Chrome a lot. I've used Opera. I do find that there's a slight difference in speed. And I find that the Opera is faster. At least I get a better response time.
Is it faster with the VPN running or both ways?
Well, you know, one of the problems about measuring speed on the Internet is that it depends on the time of day, who the ISP is, are the kids out of school.
You know, Hank, we were just sitting here in the studio right before we went on the air, and I pulled out my cell phone, and I went to look at how old Bernie Appel was.
Appel.
And you looked at, my cell phone was a Verizon provider. Yours was a
T-Mobile.
A T-Mobile provider, and while I was waiting for mine to come through, you looked it up in yours, and what you did is you put in the same search. I believe you used Chrome also.
Yes.
And you got the answer and told me, and by the time we went on the air, I still hadn't gotten it back, so I hung up.
By the way, if you want to know how fast your system is in terms of the internet, the reason I use the word system is because when people say, how fast is your internet, it could be the browser, it could be the ISP, it could be time of day, culturally, who you're connected with at the same time.
The hardware.
And also where the antenna is and all that. Try using fast.com, F-A-S-T.com, and try it at different times of the day, and you'd be surprised what the variable is.
Also try, with fast.com, you can choose the site of the server.
Right.
And try different servers at different times. But the thing that Hank left out most of all, and is the most effective in the speed, is the hardware itself. I happen to be running right now a thing called the Google Pixel. It's a very new machine. It violates all of my theories of never using a brand new machine. I was curious, so I got this one.
Well, actually, Joe was a little embarrassed because this is a brand new a smartphone, Pixel, Google, and he's running Nougat, and he's looking at me. I got this very low-end Motorola smartphone. And
twice as fast.
And you were surprised I got the answer.
But that's the point that Hank was making, that it depends on the carrier, it depends on the machine, it depends on the time of day, and it depends on whether or not you're me. Because I seem to have very bad luck with Verizon.
Oh, I got a piece of literature from Charter, or Spectrum, as you know, and I had been a Time Warner user for over 30 years, going way back into the 70s, and the letter was, you want to come back? And but they haven't changed any equipment. Why do I want to go back to them?
And they haven't changed their servers either. I have a thing called RCN, and you just
moved on to RCN
about
right?
2 or 3 months ago.
So that's very recent.
And I had been Time Warner, and I had been Verizon, and I had been a lot of things.
RCN must be very slow for you.
It's the speed is about the same as I was getting. It's about twice as fast as Verizon's DSL, which isn't very fast. It should be a lot faster than that. But it comes with some other things. Have you heard about TiVo?
No. I know what TiVo is, but
well,
TiVo's part of the RCN offering?
It's built into RCN. You even get the TiVo set-top box and so on. I get things like YouTube and Netflix on my TV. I don't have to fool around with Chromecast and things like that. It's interesting. Their customer service is a magnitude better than Time Warner's.
Well, it's now called Spectrum or Charter.
That doesn't it's Spectrum, not Charter, and that doesn't really matter, Hank, because it's the same company.
It's the same equipment they're using. Hey, Joe. Let me tell you what happened in very recently. Okay, Bitdefender, which is an antivirus vendor, was working with the Romanian police who had gotten a hold of.
Hank, you actually said that with a straight face.
Yes, I did.
With the Romanian police?
Yes. And what it is that the Romanian police was able to get a hold of the BART ransomware program.
We don't want to know how the Romanian police did that, but it's probably they walked into their back office and said, hey, chief, let me have a copy of that.
Well, you know, in a case like that, you don't really have any complaints about them doing that, okay? Because I remember, was it a week ago? We talk about, there's certain things you say, well, there's such thing as First Amendment rights and privacy and all that. And then we're talking about child porn. You say, those are the scum of the earth. I don't care what you do with them.
That's right. And they are particularly excepted from First Amendment rights. It goes down to basically my rights end at the tip of your nose. As soon as I punch your nose, my rights go down the drain.
What happened was that the Bitdefender did some reverse engineering on the BART ransomware, and they came up with a fix for it. So,
First, before you go any further, Hank, just very quickly, because some people just tuned in here for the first time, what is ransomware, and why is BART ransomware more significant?
Well, first of all, let's for those who may not know the term ransomware, what it is that your data somehow got caught in some phishing or malware web where they encrypt your data, and if you want your data, they said, pay us a ransom in Bitcoin. And the problem is that you may be willing to pay for it, but there's no guarantee you're going to get it. It's like a, you know, like a having a child kidnapped, but after you pay the ransom, there's no guarantee that you're going to get anything.
I hate to do this because it means we're never going to get to the end of the story, but Hank, what is Bitcoin?
Okay, Bitcoin is a, it's not, well, let's put it this way. It's not recognized as legal currency.
It's not coin either.
No. It's a monetary value that I think it ranges from one end of the spectrum to the other.
No, it's now selling for well over
a thousand, okay?
Per coin.
But it also dropped way down, too, last year.
It was up as high as 3,000.
Yeah. Well, it did do a drop when the International Monetary Fund says they will not recognize it as currency.
That's when it hurt. Yeah. But the weird thing is it uses a lot of terminology that I can't explain to you, and I'm not sure Hank can, but if you can mine Bitcoin, I don't know what that means, and you can use the Bitcoin that you mine, and Bitcoin can't be traced, and I don't know who's going to give you the $1,000 for the non-existent coin that you have. It's all very confusing.
Well, what it is that basically it's malware that that was socially engineered to get into your system. And what it does in turn is
that's BART, not
no.
Bitcoin.
Actually, most ransomware is that way. What it does is that it encrypts all your data, and when it encrypts your data, you're locked out. And if you want it, and by the way, some hospitals have paid for it, to free it up. Some have paid and successfully been able to retrieve the data. Some have paid the data and.
In each case, they paid with Bitcoin. But where do you buy Bitcoin?
I don't know.
And how do you sell it?
I don't know.
And how do you transfer it?
Well, it's like if you were to ask me, gee, seems like there's a business in ransomware. Maybe I should get into it. And if you ask me the question, how do I get started in ransomware? I would say to you, I don't know.
The problem is it's all very, very complicated. Also, nobody wants to admit that they know anything about it.
Well, what it is that Bitdefender said the software is for free, that if you need it, just contact them and they'll make it available to you. And then the question I said to myself, I read all these articles. I think this is great. You know, Bitdefender is doing a good thing. They're doing they're doing the right thing. But does anyone know what the BART ransomware look like?
Well, the question is, how do you know? Before you go over to Bitdefender and get their free program to clean it out, how do you know you need it cleaned out? And there is an answer to that.
Yeah, I'll give you an example, okay? Hey, Joe, I just went on vacation. I'm making this up now, okay? I just went on vacation. I went to the Baltic, and I had my camera with me, and I took a lot of beautiful pictures of, cathedrals and so on. And I want to send these pictures to you. I'm going to call it photo.zip, and you could look at the pictures. What would you say to that?
I would say, Hank, if you infect my machine, I'm going to turn you over to the mafia.
No. Actually, first of all, you have to verify that you the message.
Such a message, whether from Hank or from you or from anybody else, before I opened up that zip file, particularly a zip file, but there are other files.
Well, let me just say that it's been sent out where it's under a phony name or someone you may know, but it's a correct name, but the person never sent it to you.
Right.
And it's called photos.zip or photo.zip or picture.zip. And if you unzip it, you've had it.
So what I do, and I've made this a rule among all the people who use my machine, if something comes in with an attachment, before you're allowed to open that attachment, you have to contact on the telephone the sender and say, did you send me such and such an attachment? And you know, I've done that three times so far. One of them said yes, and I opened it, and it was fine. Two of them said no, and I have no idea what was in it. I sent it out to somebody I know who collects such things.
Well, you know, I was asked the question, how would they do this? You remember what happened 6-7 months ago when we were talking about Yahoo? They got hacked, $500,000. I think more than $500,000.
The first hack was $500,000.
Yeah, where they were able to get email addresses and their password, and it's so easy that if they got all these names and password, someone who wants to commit a ransomware, they just send you a message, say, hey, listen, I'm your nephew, I'm your father, I'm your friend, or whatever it is. I got some pictures for you. Or worse yet, you know, what you could easily fall for. Hey, I got a new baby boy, a new baby girl. You got to see these pictures. And it says photos.zip, and you'd be anxious to open it up.
I have a friend who regularly sends me pictures that way of things like, the message will be, this is the most amazing thing. You got to open it, Joe. The first time I called him, and he said, yeah, I sent it. And now I don't bother to call him. I hate to tell you this, Hank, I don't bother to open them either.
Oh, okay. So just be careful of a BART ransomware where it comes in, where it's a zip file. Now, we use a term picture.zip, photo.zip, and photos.zip. But now that we talk about it, they could just rename that zip file to something else. So you just have to be careful. It's a zip file, okay?
And incidentally, they use zip because it's probably the most common of the compressing programs. But it might come with the RAR suffix.
Yeah, RAR.
There are probably 50 different suffixes that they can use. Depending on where you're located, they'll use one of the more popular ones. Make it a rule of thumb. Never open something you don't know what it is.
Now, would you say that, but you know what is a very commonly popular thing that is opened up that people wouldn't even think twice? PowerPoint presentations.
Same thing. Anything that you're opening up that you can't examine before you open it, don't open it.
Well, I'm going to let you in on a secret, okay? As you know, I have a lot of old machines at home, and for Black Friday, I got a brand new $100 machine from Dell, and the only thing I do with it is go on the internet, browse. I don't care what happens because I just do a factory reset if anything happens.
And that's,
I don't do anything else on it, though.
That's one of the reasons that a lot of people like Chromebooks, Hank.
No. You could have a Chromebook, but if your data got encrypted, I don't care if you got a Chromebook, you've had it, okay?
Although
it's in the cloud, okay?
It's in the cloud. And the reason I say a Chromebook is, if the Chromebook itself gets encrypted, just turn it off and turn it on again, and it downloads the operating system all over.
Okay, so what we're saying is on attachments, on files, actually these are attachments, okay, so anything that's attached, unless you really know the person or you're expecting it, be very wary of it. I know some people, they run it on a separate machine, and I'll tell you what some people do, they run it in a sandbox.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, can you explain what sandbox is?
This is they open it up, and a section of your hardware has been set aside by software, and anything that can run runs in there.
A virtual operating system is a sandbox.
But it never comes out of there. It's locked in. The problem is, a few years ago, you could open up an email and get infected. Now most email readers have a certain amount of protection built into them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you this, any engineer who has the ability to write a piece of software that will protect you knows another engineer who can write a piece of software that will bypass that protection.
You know, so long as it is software, nothing will ever be 100%. There was a way.
Well, that's one way of phrasing it. I think as long as it's in software, everything is 100% untrustworthy.
Okay. I will go one step further, although a lot of people would disagree with me on it, okay? If it's wireless, it's never 100% safe.
I believe his name was Louis Freer, the former head of the FBI.
Right.
And he was asked point blank, how safe is it to do business on the internet? And he said he doesn't know because he would never do it, never has, never will.
Well, you know, my philosophy is anything that's transactional, hardwire. If I don't have a hardwire, I don't do it.
And yet you're not 100% safe that
right. way. Hey, you know, something happened with Twitter. They came up with a new function. Did you know what that new function is?
I know it. I wish it was.
Well, what the function is that the 140-character limit got, in a way, extended. And what they did was they extended it by saying they don't count the username anymore in the message. So, therefore, you can pick up a couple of extra characters.
Well, they did something else also. They said you could encrypt and send in a link in your Twitter message, a link for a picture. And using steganography, that picture could contain an encyclopedia of information, including malware.
Yes. By the way, with Twitter, one of the things they've been in business for a couple of years now, they still haven't figured out how to monetize it to make it a business.
I know two people who have tried with some success. They wrote a book on how to use Twitter.
Yeah, they make their money on the book. Hey, Joe, the one thing that, in a way, it's computing. In a way, it's not computing, but I think it's very important that we talk about it, okay? Is that the U.S. Governors Highway Safety Association did a report based on actual numbers that they have. And in the past year, 2016, there's been an 11% increase in pedestrian fatalities because they were sidetracked on their smartphone.
They're making a big deal of it now, but going back about 15, maybe 20 years.
Oh, you're talking about the Walkman?
I was crossing the street, 12th Street and University Place. There was a fair amount of traffic. I waited for the lights to change. As I started to cross, somebody came making a left turn and literally hit me, but I jumped up and I landed on their hood.
But wow, you got hit by a car.
I was hit, and the guy slammed on the brakes and jumped out and took his earphones off and said, I'm sorry. Well, that's the same thing that's happening today.
But how do you get people to realize that you got to pay attention when you're crossing the street? The thing is, at least with the Sony Walkman, you still have sight. When people are texting, they're not only are they not aware of their surrounding, but their eyes is on the smartphone.
No, it really doesn't have to be. I've seen people text.
Oh, yeah. I've seen young kids do it with a unit in their pocket.
In their pocket. And I still haven't figured that out yet, but it works. It's a very dangerous thing. When you're driving while you're texting, you are obviously not paying 100% attention to what's on the road in front of you.
Well, you have to. Somebody
came up with a way of, if the car was in motion, disabling everything except the incoming messages. That technology
it can be. The technology is there. But, however, can I tell you what the flaw in that thinking is? The person texting is not the driver.
That's right. And so people objected to it. And remember, when it comes to a choice between marketing, that is selling, and safety, selling will always take precedence over safety. Same thing with our government.
Hey, by the way, you know, there was something that was reported on, and the news media sort of like said, it happened. And you and I came up with the same conclusion that it has an impact, but no one really knows what that impact is. And the news item was in the New York Times saying that Chase had ads on 400,000 sites, and they cut it to 5,000 sites, and they got the same results. You know what that means.
No, but let me go into that a little bit further, Hank. Chase had a contract to go out at random on 400,000, well, not necessarily 400,000.
Well, it's not at random. It's like wherever you can throw it, you throw it on.
It was that they wanted to have the potential of 400,000 eyeballs. Didn't matter where those eyes were.
Well, not 400,000 eyes, but 400,000 sites that would display their ad.
Display their ad.
Right.
Then they tested that against being highly selective, picking out 4,000 sites that they felt the viewers of that site would be a potential customer. What do you think happened?
They got the same result when they went 400,000 sites to 5,000 sites.
Now, that's
for banking. It may be a little different for retail and for another company.
And they were paying more per site for the 4,000 sites than they were for the 400,000 sites, but they weren't paying 10 times more.
Right.
We're paying
By the way, now a number of large companies, not that they're going to do what Chase did, but they're testing the same mode, and that has an impact on Facebook, that has an impact on Google. It's going to affect their revenues.
Yes, it has to. Facebook is big because it can sell, I think it's 2 billion sites or something
like
that.
Yeah, and also some of the companies have already withdrawn from advertising on Facebook because they said, you're putting us in ads where we don't want to be with associated with that content. They've been complaining about that, too.
And that's true of all. YouTube has been faced with that. Everybody who is dealing with content, would you like to have, Hank, your ad put onto a content of a site that wants to limit immigration to white people?
Well, I think that what they were referencing was smut sites that they really didn't want to be associated with.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, it is.
It can be philosophical smut. It can be political smut. It's smut, and I don't want my product associated with it.
Well, seriously, do you think that it's do you think over the long term it's going to impact the revenues of these companies where it seems like they're growing by leaps and bounds what they get from ads?
Absolutely, it's going to affect them. I'll give you one not really related but philosophically related. The New York Times ran a story that Bill O'Reilly and his company paid out $13 million
for harassment.
For sexual harassment, mm-hmm. And within one full week, 18 major, large Fortune 500
Mercedes.
Companies.
Mercedes was the first to announce
they,
it.
They dropped out because they said, don't want to be associated with that kind of stuff.
Well, you heard what happened to Pepsi.
What happened to Pepsi?
Oh, you didn't hear about it?
No.
Oh, well, they had an ad, and they had someone drinking a bottle of Pepsi, or a can of Pepsi, okay?
Yeah.
It was a cop. And a lot of people objected to that, and they took Pepsi to task on it. And
they objected to a cop drinking the product?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't buy that.
Well, you're going to always get someone involved in it. Listen, in the time that we have, because what I want to do is that Joe Rejeski, who does a feature segment for us, he has more... was it simple tips for the busy person? But that we'll do in a few minutes from now. We're not ready for that.
Incidentally, I just want to interrupt you, Hank, and say Joe has a couple of books out on that subject,
mm-hmm.
And they're all valid. That's things maybe you already know, but they're things you also haven't thought of.
Well, today's feature is a little different. I listened to it, and I said, this one is a little different, but you know what? It was fun. I mean, let me just say that. So when you hear it, you'll understand what he did, okay? Instead of giving you a tip, he gave you something that was fun. And I'll just leave it at that.
Leave it at that.
And then we have Marty Winston. He's going to be talking about, his continuation on, his home automation. And I've been sending him a lot of stuff that... I don't know. Some of the there's two things that he and I agree on. Okay, the Internet of Things, where you can connect things together, it's
a wild west.
It is not ready for prime time.
It's the wild west, and one day we'll devote a show to it because we each have our own opinions on it. But the one Internet of Things product that I really want to buy for myself, it's a light bulb. And over the Internet, you can change the colors that come out of the light bulb.
Yes.
And so somebody could be reading a book, and suddenly it turns to purple. and somebody else could be reading a book, and suddenly it turns to blue?
Well, it turns out I gave him a study that was done, and the study shows that 27% of the people that they survey do have something that is connected in some smart way with a smartphone. However, most of the people say that I use the word gadgets, okay? They feel that the biggest obstacle is cost. The cost is so high that it doesn't justify the functions that it provides.
And I think the biggest obstacle is security, because if I have my front door lock hooked up to my smartphone, I know somebody's going to hack in and take everything I own.
Well, before we get to the feature segments, I'm going to ask you a simple question, Joe. You have a Samsung smart TV?
No, I don't, and I heard that that's hackable also. But Hank...
Wait. The reason why I'm asking you is that people, you know what they say to me? I don't have that set on all the time. I got news for you. Your TV, because of instant on, it's on all the time. People don't realize that.
It is indeed, except yours is not, is it?
Well, I do something different. I don't have I did at one time have the internet cable hooked up to it. So I just disconnected the cable. So you can leave it on if you want to. You're fine.
Yeah, that'll do it. But there are some other ones that are on all the time that you don't want to get involved in that. I found that I put an electric garage door opener, and it was my neighbor's was on the internet. Mine was just plugged into the wall. His was kept opening and closing.
By the way, I have an automatic garage door. You can't open it.
You can't open it.
You know why?
You keep it locked.
I have the latch, and I pull the latch on inside.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, you know what? Before we get carried away, let's get to those feature segments right now.
This week on Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Hey, we're going to have fun till your daddy takes your Google away. Hey, it's time for Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Busy people like you. I'm Joe Rejeski, author of the soon-to-be-released Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. For the past few months, I've been bringing you computer tips to help you finish work early. But every now and then, we need a break. So everyone knows that you use Google to search, but there are a number of surprises, tricks, doodads, whatever you want to call them, that have nothing to do with searching, but are going to bring you seconds, maybe even minutes of fun. Here are 10 surprises you can enter into Google just for fun. Number one, enter into Google, do a barrel roll. Do a barrel roll will do a 360 of your search window. Give it a shot right now. I'll wait. Actually, no, I gotta keep moving. Number two, Zerg Rush. Zerg Rush, when you search for it, launches a game called Zerg Rush that launches an attack on your search results. Knock out the O's by clicking on them. All that time you're saving by using Google, you can throw that right out the window right now. Number three, search for fun facts. Google will display random facts that are fun. Hence the term, fun facts. Number four, find Chuck Norris, and then click on the first link that is displayed. Wait, what? I'm sorry, one moment, please. Okay, that was my attorney. That's all I'm legally permitted to say on this matter. Find Chuck Norris. Okay, number five, Google in 1998. Take a walk down memory lane by entering Google in 1998. Google incorporated in 1998, and when you Google in 1998, you're searching the way our ancestors did in ye olden times. Number six, visit google.com/Pac-Man. It's virtual reality from the 80s, folks. Your reality is eating dots in a maze and being chased by ghosts, and then eating a big dot that lets you eat the ghosts. You know, I think my family reunion is right around the corner. Not sure what made me think of that. Number seven, anagram. Look at did you mean. When you search for anagram, you're going to have to think a little to get this one. Just look where it says nag a ram. Number eight, askew, A-S-K-E-W. Askew is another one you just need to try. Number 9, enter an actor's name and then type bacon number. And number 10, do you need to make a decision and need to flip a coin, roll a die, or just spin a dreidel? Well, search for flip a coin, roll a die, or play dreidel. And there you go, 10 fun pack Google surprises. Try these now and you'll have minutes of fun. And that's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Do you have a computer tip for me? Let me know. Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Rejewski. Over and out.
Thank you, Joe. Public service announcements. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have an Apple presentation Friday, April the 7th. Starting meeting time is 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on electronic use of your library Thursday, April the 6th. Meeting time starts at 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor, White Plains, New York. Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting on Tuesday, April the 11th. Starting meeting time is 7:15 p.m. Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Mall, West Nyack, New York. New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Stay Home, Stay Safe, How Technology Helps Seniors Remain in Their Own Homes. By the way, that presentation is by our very own Dr. Alfred Poor, Thursday, April the 13th. Meeting starts at 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in room 408. Long Island Mac Users Group, Friday, April the 14th. Meeting time starts at 7 p.m. New York Institute of Technology Old Westbury Campus, located on Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane. They meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Schurer Hall. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on scary alphabet soup. In this case, they're referring to Google when they say alphabet. They meet on Thursday, April the 27th. Starting meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Middletown Township Public Library, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. All these meetings are open to the public. They hope that you're going to be able to make some of them.
Good evening. I'm just back from the eye doctor, where I learned that my eyes are not getting quite enough moisture. So what does that have to do with the house we're building? Reference to that, 40yearhouse.com. Well, moisture is in part due to internal factors and in part due to the environment, at least in terms of having enough wetness on the eye. And when you don't, by the way, you've got problems ahead, and you can look that up. I'm old enough that those problems are a little more pronounced for me than they are for some of you, but overall, there wasn't much change in my eyesight over the last several years, and I just want to deal with the whole concept of moisture in a smart house. Moisture can be too high. Moisture can be too low. Am I stating the obvious here? Are you measuring it? Do you measure it in your house? Do you know where it should be? Now, it isn't just about your eyes, although that brought the lesson pretty much to a focus for me, no pun intended. Moisture, it has an impact on so many things in a structure. The dryness or dampness of the wood have an effect on the extent to which the wood will warp or not warp, rot or not rot, get dry and crumbly, change its shape, change its resilience, change its characteristics. So certainly for structural issues, for your furniture, for walls to some extent, which are mostly a gypsum product, and for floors, ceilings, and internal framing, moisture has to be part of what's on your mind. But think about your electronics. For your electronics, moisture is a factor in determining oxidation, rust, bad connections, all of that kind of thing. Part of the discipline of building a house designed to do without major need for repairs or replacement over a 40-year term is to look at chains of consequence. It's kind of fighting Murphy's Law. Find out what can go bad and do everything you can to remove it. Find out what can cause complications, something that may not go bad directly for your stuff, but is then going to make something go bad for something in the middle, for something in the middle, for something in the middle that causes chains of consequence, causes harm, causes frustration in the goal of being able to act as if nothing will ever go wrong. Hey, be nice if nothing could ever go wrong, wouldn't it? But then we wouldn't have half the disciplines we have today. So in the context of the house, we pay some attention to relative humidity. And by the way, I want to come back to another important example for any of you who happen to have ammunition in the house. Static electricity and ammunition, or the things that make ammunition, bad combination. So you want to maintain at least a minimal moisture level, even if you don't care about pampering your wood or your furniture or any of that stuff. And too much moisture, again, encourages oxidation, which is also bad, not only for ammunitions, but for the gun it goes in. You don't have to love or hate guns. There are people who have them. Now, the same factors impact your tools, your power tools. The same factors can impact every bit of plumbing, every bit of cooking utensil, every bit of everything in the house. So, you know, it's so invisible. Humidity levels are so easy to ignore. You probably have 10 times as many things to measure temperature as you do things to measure humidity. I'm going to suggest that's very easy to remedy and that you start doing it. You start taking a look at the relative humidity levels. Do some reading up. There's plenty of information online on where you want to have it. And if you have special factors where you live, it might be medicine. It might be dry eye, the thing that brought this to my attention. It might be the idea of having gunpowder or other chemicals or paints or cans or stored stuff or food prep stuff, you get the idea. Pretty much everything that's around us all day long is impacted one way or another by relative humidity. Keep an eye on it. Now, in the 40-year house plan, we've known for a long time to incorporate, largely because we're in South Carolina, a massive dehumidifier in the basement. We have a Honeywell unit that can crank 90 pints a day out of moist air. But now I'm committed to also adding a humidifier to it, something probably you're going to use steam humidifier technology, to make sure that we don't drop the humidity level too low. We already have more than 30, no, well, I'm not sure yet. I know we have more than 20. We'll probably end up having more than 50 humidity sensors in the house. So monitoring those levels is important. And intervening in the usual controls of humidifiers, dehumidifiers, and other moisture factors in a house is something that advanced automation can do. Sometimes you don't need to. Sometimes the things they've set up for themselves are plenty and enough. But where you do need to, brother, it's important. You really want to make sure that you're not encouraging an early demise to things that are part of your life and have no reason to quit on you other than the fact that you haven't paid attention to relative humidity. It's the wet and dry of it all. And now back to you.
Thank you, Marty. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org. And we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.